The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hey, it's Mariana. I'm the host of the Life with Mariana podcast, and this episode is all about egg freezing, and I actually posted this on my Instagram stories, and I don't think I've ever gotten so many questions from you guys to ask a guest because you were so interested about this topic. We talk about what is egg freezing and why do people do it, when should you freeze your eggs, what happens when you want to use your eggs in the future, what is the process like, who's a good candidate, and what you should consider when finding a clinic and doctor to freeze your eggs. If you guys want to learn a little bit about this, we are actually talking to Spring Fertility. They have locations in the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as New York and Portland, Oregon. You can follow them on Instagram at Spring Fertility for access to evidence-based fertility education, events, and more. Spring Fertility specializes in IVF, embryo freezing, egg freezing, and third-party donor services. I spoke with Dr. Hancock in this episode. She's a reproductive endocrinologist, as well as a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist. She is so passionate about serving as a true partner for individuals and couples as they achieve their family-building goals and plan for their future. If you guys want to book a consultation at Spring Fertility, you guys can use code Mariana when booking for $150 off a fertility consult. This cannot be combined with commercial insurance. If you guys want to learn a little bit more about this, she answers so many of your questions that you guys ask, and I hope that this is a helpful episode for you. So a lot of people, I think, are really curious about this scenario. They have been thinking about freezing eggs or embryos. They want to go through the process, but they have so many questions. I posted this on my Instagram, and I got so many questions that people wanted to know. And one of the most commonly asked ones is, like, how and when do I start the process? Like, what is the right age for this? When is too early? When is too late? So I think the timeline here is the first question I want to get to.
That's fantastic. Okay, so we get this question all the time. Patients come in for consult and they're like, am I too late? Am I too early? Or they're like, oh my gosh, I'm too late. Or, you know, that is like hugely important. And my stance is that honestly, if you're thinking about doing it, the most helpful thing that you can do is come in and talk to your doctor about your medical background, your gynecologic history, any family history, doing things like an ultrasound, getting some lab work done. And we can go into more details about exactly what all of that looks like. But that really helps to come up with some factual information, like about medical pieces of the picture. And then I spend a lot of time talking to my patients about what their actual goals are in terms of their life, in terms of their family building. And then with all of that combined, then we start to think about, okay, does this make sense now? Does this make sense, you know, several years in the future? Does this make sense at all? Is this something that you want to do? And that's really how we come to that answer. So there's really not like a one size fits all. Everyone should do it by X, Y, and Z age. That's not really how we sort of approach it. Generally, egg quality is at its best before age 35. And so if somebody is considering doing this, it's more efficient when you're younger than 35, but it absolutely is still extremely valuable and an important part of people's family building process after the age of 35 as well. So there's not like, oh, I'm after 35, this is not worth it for me. That is absolutely not like a one size fits all, like blanket statement. What it really is a combination, like I said, of things in your gynecologic picture, your ultrasound, your blood work, and your goals, and all of that together helps you and your doctor figure out, okay, this makes sense or this doesn't make sense.
And we mentioned this, and so people that maybe aren't familiar with this, what is the difference between egg freezing and embryo freezing?
So we have eggs in our ovaries, and when we get pregnant, you ovulate one egg, which is a single cell, from your ovary. And if you have sex, the timing works out, you're trying to get pregnant, one single sperm, which is also a single cell, will fertilize an egg. And then once that happens, the fertilization sort of jumpstart this process where that egg cell starts to divide and divide and divide, and it grows into what we call an embryo, which has like 200 cells and is a combination of DNA from the mom, from the egg, and DNA from the dad, from the sperm. And an embryo has a potential to grow into a fetus, which obviously can then go on to be a baby. And so an egg is your own single cell egg with your own genetic. And an embryo is a fertilized egg that has started to grow and divide. And so that's like the sort of like biology basics between the two.
Okay, great. So let's say you're listening right now and you're like, okay, what is the scenario for me? Let's say you are single and you're thinking about, you know, maybe one day in the future, you want to have kids, you're not with a partner yet. And then you want to say, okay, I'm going to freeze my eggs because one day later down the line, I maybe want to have kids, I'm getting a little bit older. That's a scenario of like egg freezing. Or if you are in a partnership or you're married or you're with somebody, you might still freeze only eggs at that time. And then embryo is if it's fertilized with sperm. So that's really the main difference here. So I think a lot of listeners probably listening want to know more about egg freezing, which we'll talk more about in this episode, because I think especially for women in their 20s and 30s, or maybe they're a little bit younger and they want to focus on something else, you know, and planning a family later, they really want to think about egg freezing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the way I like to phrase it is that egg freezing is a great way to preserve your reproductive autonomy. So basically, in a normal month, your ovary gets one egg ready to ovulate and ovulates one egg. But when we freeze eggs, we want to freeze a whole bunch of eggs, right? And so we give you hormones, which are the same hormones that your brain normally puts out in a menstrual cycle, but slightly higher dose. And those hormones give a signal to your ovary that says, hey, ovaries, instead of giving me one egg this month, let's grow all the eggs that the ovaries allocated for that month. That might be 5, 10, 15. And we support them with the hormone medications to continue them growing. And once they all reach a certain size, we do the retrieval, which is a minimally invasive transvaginal retrieval, and collect all the eggs, and then they're frozen at that single cell egg stage. So that's like a broad strokes sort of picture. And then they can be used at any point in the future to be thawed and made into embryos. And when and why you use those eggs looks really different for many different women. And the eggs can come into play if, let's say, you run into age-related infertility. So we know after 35, natural fertility rates start to go down. And then after 40, unfortunately, they start to go down a little bit further. And when women run into age-related infertility, a great solution is often to go back and use their previously frozen eggs. So that might be one scenario where someone's coming back to use their eggs. Or let's say somebody freezes their eggs in the scenario you just described, and 2 years later have met someone and they start trying, and we determine, you know, they're unable to get pregnant, and we determine that there's an issue with their fallopian tubes, or maybe their partner doesn't have sperm, or maybe they have large fibroids in their uterus, any reason that somebody might have a fertility issue or run into a fertility diagnosis, you could also just go back and use your eggs. Mm-hmm. So it sort of serves two purposes. It can protect against age-related infertility, and it can also protect against any more immediate source of infertility.
And I think before we even get to that point, are there things that maybe we're in our 20s we should be checking? Like, should we go and check our follicle count? Should we do genetic testing for ourselves? Like, what are these things that we could do so that we're prepared, so it's not just when we're ready to become parents, but is there information that we could know earlier on?
That's a good question. And there's lots of sort of different camps of what people kind of feel in terms of proactively getting a sense of your ovarian reserve or doing an ultrasound. That when we do the ultrasound, what we're looking at is how many eggs would we be able to get in a retrieval, or checking your AMH. And so any one of those things in a vacuum is probably not helpful, right? Just checking your AMH and getting a number might not actually be all that helpful for you. It probably is helpful to do that in the context of getting an AMH, getting an ultrasound, talking to a reproductive specialist, like an infertility physician, about the results and about your goals. And then you can sort of make an informed decision. And I feel that knowledge is power, information is power, and the best way to make a decision is an informed decision. And so my sense is that if you're thinking about it or concerned about it, actually does not hurt to come in, check your AMH, do an ultrasound, review your medical gynecologic histories with a fertility doctor, and understand sort of what your reserve looks like and if you have any risk factors for future infertility, because those things probably will help you make the right decision for yourself. Does that make sense?
For sure.
And so the reason that I feel that way is because we see patients for that type of appointment all the time. And I have picked up a couple of patients where even though they were young, they had exceptionally low egg reserve for their age. And we know egg reserve goes down with age. And so if it's already low at age 27, 28, those people benefited massively from finding out that information early. And then they were able to act on it and potentially start their process of fertility preservation and egg freezing earlier. So they're getting more eggs and those eggs are better quality. And so they're really benefiting from having had that information. But that's for most people, they're going to have an average egg quality and no real immediate risk factors for infertility. Then, you know, it's helpful for them to have that information, but they might not need to necessarily act on it right away.
And let's say, okay, you're listening, you're like, I want to freeze my eggs. What happens after I've decided to do this?
In our center, it's very similar. In a lot of centers, you have a coordinator. We track your menstrual cycle. So we get a sense of sort of how often you're menstruating, which tells us, you know, sort of the cadence of your menstrual cycles. And based off of that, we sync up to your menstrual cycle. A lot of the very initial steps is like calendar logistics. So I've got a work trip on this day. I've got to do a presentation on this day. I am out of town on these dates. And so it's like syncing up between your menstrual cycle and your calendar restrictions. A lot of it is that. And that can take like 2 weeks to like sort that out. And once we figured out when you're going to start, which is usually approximately around the start of your menstrual cycle, you come into the office, we do an ultrasound just to make sure there's not any cysts on the ovaries, and we sort of recheck the egg count so we know what our sort of goal number of eggs is for the retrieval. That night, you start injections, and the injections, another huge point of stress for people because you're doing self-injections, so you administer them yourself. Some are straightforward and easy to use. It's like a pen. If anyone has relatives that have diabetes, the insulin comes in like a little pen that you dial up with this teeny tiny little needle. So that's relatively user-friendly. Some of them you do have to mix, and you have a nurse that sort of teaches you how to do all this and gets you all prepared. And those injections you take every night for about 9 to 12 days. It varies from person to person, depending on how fast the eggs grow. And then over that 9 to 12 day time period where you're taking the injections, you usually come into the office like about 5 times. And we do, again, transvaginal ultrasound to check the growth of the eggs. And we monitor your estrogen level, which tells us how well the eggs are growing. And somewhere around day 10, 11, 12, eggs have reached a certain size, your estrogen has reached a certain level, then we know you're ready for the retrieval. So once we've determined you're ready for the retrieval, on that last night of injections, you take what we call the trigger shot, which sounds very scary. In all reality, it's the same type of injection. It's just a slightly different medication that gets the eggs ready to actually come out when we do the retrieval. And then 36 hours later, you come in. It's outpatient surgery, ambulatory surgery. We induce anesthesia. It's a mid-level anesthesia. So if anyone's ever had a relative that has had like colonoscopy, something like that, same anesthesia. So you're totally asleep. You don't feel anything. You don't remember anything. And the way that we retrieve the eggs is with this little tiny transvaginal needle that we introduce into each of the little follicle, which is where each of the eggs are in the ovaries. And we sort of drain the fluid from each follicle and the egg is floating within that fluid. And so that's how we collect all of the eggs.
Going back to the shot part of it. So
yes,
are the shots painful? Like if you're injecting yourself, obviously it's safe to do yourself. Like does a nurse show you how to do it? What does it feel like? What's the pain level?
you do like some teaching modules and you meet with your nurse and they practice like how to put the needles onto the syringes, how to mix any of the medications that need to be mixed. So they like teach you how to actually get everything set up. And then they also teach how to do the injections. So they're little tiny insulin needles and you inject them on your belly in the skin right next to your belly button that you can sort of pinch and you inject it right into that skin. It's like a little tiny needle prick, much smaller needle than like a vaccine, a fraction of the size. So if anyone's gotten their vaccines, which hopefully everyone has, that it's much less than that. So a tiny little needle. So it hurts less than that. There's no like soreness like after a vaccine. It's just like a tiny little bit of bruising some people get at the site where they do the injections. And so you rotate to different areas on the skin around your belly button. And some people, if you ice your stomach before, that can really help. Then you don't even feel the needle when it goes in.
Okay. And so let's talk about physical and emotional feelings. So during these 9 to 12 days when you're injecting yourself, what might you feel like physically?
So the first 5-6 days of injections, you actually feel okay, feel pretty normal. Your estrogen levels aren't really that much above what they would be in your natural menstrual cycle, like at the time of ovulation. And ovaries aren't quite that enlarged yet with the eggs because the eggs have just started to grow. It's really the second week of injections that you're starting to feel tired because your body's working really hard to grow eggs and your estrogen level is going up. For some people, when their estrogen level is elevated and because the ovaries are enlarged, they can feel sort of bloated. You might have a little bit of extra water weight. Physically, the ovaries are probably like 5 to 6 times that they normally are. So in a normal world, when we walk around, our ovaries are maybe the size of like even smaller than a plum. Like they're pretty small. And they're mobile. They float around in your pelvis. You don't really notice them unless you have like a big cyst on your ovary. When all of the eggs are enlarged, the entire ovary can grow to be the size of like an orange or a grapefruit. So you definitely feel bloated, full. It's like a heaviness in your pelvis. And that compounds as you go through that second week of injections. And so generally by the day that you're feeling that you're ready for that final injection, you're really feeling like super bloated and just kind of like a gross heaviness in your pelvis. And then emotionally, most people do okay. You're sometimes a little bit more emotional than you normally are. Like you might be triggered to cry a little bit more easily. You're certainly very tired. So you can also be on edge and be kind of like cranky and you feel sort of bloated and gross. So that might make you a little bit more cranky. And then after the retrieval, your estrogen is coming, like in the emotional side of things, your estrogen is coming from a really high level, like crashing down. So for people who have PMS symptoms, it might be amplified a little bit in that 4 or 5 days after the retrieval, because it's sort of like a PMS on steroids, so to speak. And that is hard. And people aren't always expecting that because they think like, okay, great. I did my injections, got through the whole thing, did my retrieval, like I should be in the clear. And then they kind of encounter that post-retrieval. That I think is sometimes surprising, but no joke for sure.
Okay. So I think people will probably like, okay, but I've got to work. I've got to go to school. I have like things I need to do in my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you work as normal during this time? Do you have to take time off? Like how does it work with like our real life?
Well, yeah, that varies from person to person. Most people I tell, like while you're taking the injections, even in the second week when you're super bloated, you're functional. You're just like maybe wearing workout, like yoga pants and a sweater. Like you're not wearing like high-waisted rigid jeans because you're like would be uncomfortable, but you're like tired, maybe a little cranky, but you can get work done and like you can go to work, you can get everything done that you need to do. It's really after the retrieval that you're sort of having those PMS type symptoms. You're pretty bloated and you're also now sore for a couple of days after the retrieval because we put a needle into each of the follicles. And so that's the time when people might be wanting to take off work. You don't generally need narcotic medications. You're just taking Tylenol and ibuprofen, but most people are like try to work from home for a couple of days if possible after the retrieval, because you just, you're not moving too quickly because it kind of hurts to move really fast. And then by like 4 or 5 days after the retrieval, you're generally like starting to debloat, ovaries are going down, you're feeling more normal, pain is gone, and you are definitely, you know, can be back at work.
So now that you've gone through the process, and in the case of egg freezing, mm-hmm. you've gone through the retrieval, is there a certain number that you're looking for that you're like, okay, this is the healthy amount of eggs that we are aiming for at the end of this? Because I think that's really helpful for people to say, okay, one time was good enough for me, or are you like, the number's not quite where I would like it to be, I need to consider doing this again?
So at the time when you have finished your egg freezing, the information that we have is we know the number of eggs that we have frozen and your age. But since we're freezing the eggs at a single cell egg stage, we don't actually know the quality of each egg at the time that we're freezing it. And so we have to use the information that we have, which is the number of eggs and your age. Based on your age and the number of eggs, we can predict the likelihood of live birth. So with your 12, 38-year-old eggs, we can say you have an 84% likelihood of live birth, or 85% likelihood of live birth, or whatever it works out to be. And once we have that number, we can then talk about that number in the context of your goals and what your own risk tolerance is. And you might say, okay, that feels pretty good. 84% likelihood of live birth as my backup plan. Like that feels good. I'm okay with that. Or you might say, and I've had patients in this scenario, they might say, okay, I know I'm not going to be starting my family until I'm 42 and I want 3 kids and I want 2 of them to be boys, well, then we probably do have to do additional cycles to make sure that we're prepared to meet your goals. Does that make sense? And so there's not like a magic number. Now we can look at it the other way, the inverse, because we do know what the averages are for each age group. So under 35, if you have 20 eggs frozen, that gets you to a 99% likelihood of, or high 90s, 98% likelihood of a live birth from those eggs. So that's less of like a insurance policy or backup plan and more of like a go-to plan, because you know there's an extremely high likelihood of getting a live birth from those eggs. And so for some people, that's what they want and that's what they need and that's what they'll do. And that may require them to do a second cycle. And for some people, this is like their backup. And, you know, 85% is totally reasonable as a backup plan. And so that is not like a clear cut answer. It's really more in the context of like what your own goals are.
And then how long can the eggs be stored for?
As long as you want. There's okay. No, they don't degrade, no rush to use them.
And then when the time comes when we want to use them, what happens then?
So we thaw the eggs, we fertilize them with your partner's sperm. They then start to develop and grow into an embryo. And once they're an embryo, we can do chromosome testing to actually determine, is this a viable embryo? And then those embryos can either be frozen or transferred back into the uterus at whatever time point X in the future when you want to come back and use them.
And then now we are hearing a lot about like Alabama and embryos. And so I think that's a little bit confusing for people too. I think they want to know, if I'm going to go through this, are my eggs or embryos safe to use? So what does this mean for people who want to go through this process?
That's such a hot topic. So eggs, presumably, and I don't think that there's any biological argument otherwise, eggs are a single cell that have no reproductive capacity unless they've been fertilized. So an egg is generally going to be safe in any state, regardless of the laws, because there's no world in which that egg can autonomously become an embryo. Now, there's biological ways and, you know, experimental things that we can do to make that happen, but there's no like argument that an egg is a life or a child. An embryo has been fertilized and started to grow and therefore has reproductive potential in and of itself. So it could become a child if given the appropriate environment. And this law in Alabama has now stated that all embryos have personhood and are, like, quote unquote, children. And this is really problematic for IVF care in that state because we essentially can't create embryos unless we know what the disposition is going to be for those embryos, whether they're transferred into a uterus or if they're abnormal, can they be discarded? Can they be transferred into a gestational carrier? Like, none of these questions have been figured out. And so appropriately, the IVF programs in Alabama, I believe, from what I've read most recently, have halted their IVF procedures and are not fertilizing any eggs at this time until we've determined what actually this law is going to mean. But it is not good news for fertility care. And in those states, people who have embryos frozen, those embryos now, like I said, have personhood, and the disposition has to be much more carefully thought about because they probably cannot be discarded because that is would apparently be considered manslaughter or murder in the state of Alabama. And so if this sort of snowballs and starts becoming policy in other states, it could be, you know, very serious for our field. So that's really pertains in New York State, where we are, in California, where you are. We have a relatively strong lobby and protection. But I think, as we've seen in the world today, nothing is necessarily safe. And we have to make sure that we're all, like, in touch with the appropriate policymakers to make sure that these kind of changes don't happen in our own states.
I think that's really good for people to know that if they go through this process, that they can feel more comfortable with freezing eggs, and that embryos is really what's in question here. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of other questions to get to. So mm-hmm. I want to kind of go through these yes. a little bit fast because I had so many questions from my followers. They really wanted to know. I had a lot of questions actually about people with PCOS and endometriosis. Mm-hmm. And is mm-hmm. this okay and recommended for people with this? And then is their protocol a little bit different?
PCOS and endometriosis patients can absolutely do egg freezing. With endometriosis, we take care to use certain medications and avoid certain medications that might exacerbate their pain symptoms. They might have a little bit more pain during and after the retrieval than somebody without endometriosis. And with PCOS, they also can absolutely go through the procedure. And there, we take care to give them a certain protocol where we avoid hyperstimulation, where we get way too many eggs and the hormones go too high. And so that's sort of more what we're looking out for a PCOS patient. But I have lots of patients with both who do beautifully during egg freezing. We just have to be mindful.
Okay. And for people, whether they have PCOS or endometriosis or just they don't have any of those symptoms or they're not dealing with that, are there any side effects afterwards? Like, are there long-term effects of putting our bodies through this?
No, none really. The hormones that you, when we say your hormones go up during the treatment, it's actually your own estrogen and progesterone. So it's not like you're taking, like, the equivalent of large amounts of birth control. It's your body's own estrogen and progesterone for like 2 weeks. And the levels that your hormones get to is probably about the same as they do in pregnancy. So it's totally something your body can handle.
And then are there ways outside of what we're doing with shots to prep your body best? Like, are there things that we can do in lifestyle, diet, exercise, acupuncture, like, to make this its most successful, or things that we should be avoiding during the process?
Lots and lots of research into this topic. So the short answer is that lots of purported things that have biologic plausibility that they could help, things like DHEA, CoQ10, acupuncture, all types of supplements. And none of them have been definitively proven to improve egg quality or number of eggs. That doesn't mean you shouldn't take them. It just means that it's not necessarily going to be like a magic fix. We do know, however, that smoking and morbid obesity absolutely do have a negative impact on egg quality. And so if somebody is in a state where they're obese, weight loss can be helpful to improve to optimize outcomes, and smoking cessation are really like key factors, because those are the only things that we know that can like truly negatively impact outcomes.
And I got to ask about cost, because I think it really can vary. So what is the price of something like this like? And then once we pay the fee and we're paying for the egg freezing process, what are the ongoing, you know, what do we have to spend following? Like, what does that look like for us?
So, okay. There is a cost for the egg freezing cycle, which varies from clinic to clinic. Generally, it's around like $8,000 to $12,000. Average is like $9,000 to $10,000 for the cycle. That's the ultrasounds, the medical care, anesthesia, the retrieval, embryology portion of thing. That's all included in that cycle fee. Medications are generally billed separately, and those medications are like $3,000 to $5,000, $2,000 to $5,000, depending on your protocol, the amounts of medication that you need. And then the ongoing cost is for the storage of the eggs. And that also varies from center to center, probably more expensive in urban areas, generally around like $800 to $1,200 per year. And it's generally billed on an annual basis.
Okay. And then how do we find a trusted facility? Because I think you see all these places online. There's so many different ones. Like, how do you know that a place is right for you?
There's two things. Like, there's objective things, right? And that is, what is the clinic's reputation? And you also want to know, how long have they been doing egg freezing? How long has their clinic been in practice? What are their labs' outcomes with their IVF patients? And which is like, can they take those eggs and turn them into embryos? You also really, 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 and this is probably the most important piece, want to find a clinic that has really good outcome data with their frozen eggs. So a center where enough people have actually come back to use their eggs and turn them into embryos and get pregnant with those embryos. That's the data that you really want to look at. Can they take the frozen eggs and turn them into embryos and create babies with them? And so that's like the most important sort of like objective piece of information. Subjective information is, I think the most important thing is communication with your doctor and your team. Can you get a hold of your doctor? How often are you going to see your doctor for ultrasounds? Is your doctor going to be able to do your surgery?
And then for Spring Fertility, where are the locations where we could go?
We have offices in San Francisco, a few satellites around the Bay Area, and New York. We're in Midtown, Bryant Park. And we have a new office opening in Portland.
Amazing. And if people wanted to come in for a consultation, what does that look like for them? And they don't really have to commit to anything. It's what happens in this appointment.
Right. Absolutely no commitment to anything. The appointment is exactly what I described earlier. We go through your medical history, gynecologic history, family history, your goals, your timeline. And then we do an ultrasound to take a look at the ovaries and what we think we might be able to get in terms of numbers of eggs. And we do some initial blood work, mostly looking at your hormones, primarily your AMH, which is the blood test equivalent of the ultrasound. So both of those give us a sense of your ovarian reserve, which is how we predict how many eggs you're able to get. It's about maybe an hour and 10 minute appointment.
Amazing. Well, I could have asked you a million more questions because there was so
much. I know.
Thank you so much. This is like a wealth of knowledge. I'll put all the details in the show notes. And thank you so much for coming on.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to subscribe to my podcast and rate and review, because it would mean so much to me. And follow me on Instagram at @Mariana_Hewitt to see what episodes are coming up next.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.